It's all right. 4 o'clock.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome everybody today to On Point, broadcasting live from the McIntosh Studios in downtown Minneapolis in Studio B. And in Studio A, I have longtime civil rights activist and co-host, Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, how's it going today?
Good afternoon, Mr. Allen, and good afternoon to the folks that keep us around, our listening audience, both domestic and international. These are difficult times. We'll go into that in just a minute. Beautiful day, but a cold day. Snowed once again, Mr. Allen. Do you know it snowed 91 of the last 102 days here in Minneapolis, the Twin Cities?
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it's just a dusting and a cetera, but in other words, we've had precipitation. Wind, it feels like March, by the way. That wind is brutal out there last night. But what the heck? We're in better shape than they are in Japan and Libya and other places around the world. Just a absolute catastrophe in Japan, Don.
Yes.
I estimate the casualty figures will be probably up around 15 to 20,000, if not more. Information coming in on one town in northern Japan. Half of the population, about 9,800 people, cannot be accounted for. They just disappeared. And that is just not good. A significant earthquake and tsunami. Earthquake at 8.9 on the Richter scale, if you will. The fifth largest most devastating earthquake since recorded time, modern recorded time, which started about 1900. You know, it's just, Don, I have to tell you, I watched it Thursday evening. I was watching international news, and I saw it coming ashore. And I saw all this debris and et cetera, and I knew what I was watching because I had seen the devastation in 2004 in Indonesia, but you sit there and your mouth's open. I mean, I'm not bashful about saying that it was, you know, like, oh, my God. And then you could see houses and things being washed away, and you had to know based on the way that the tidal wave came ashore. Though the quake took place 231 miles away from Tokyo, yet it was that devastating. And,
yes, it was.
It is really a significant tragedy. One of the things that it did, though, Don Allen, maybe we'll get a call from the listening audience, is that it just wiped out off the news ticker taper and everything else for almost 36 hours everything that was going on in Libya.
Yes, it did.
And, you know, they're still fighting in Libya, and Muammar Gaddafi, his military, has made all kinds of gains, and they're pushing the rebels back. In fact, a journalist was shot and killed a couple hours ago in Benghazi. And it was just amazing, man, how after, you know, being absorbed by what was going on in Libya and the oil situation, et cetera, that when that, you know, catastrophe took place in Japan, I mean, I saw for 3 or 4 hours there was nothing on Libya. Just didn't even talk about it. It was just unbelievable how these people can just tune the dial one way or the other. And by the way, the Libyan situation hasn't done anything for the price of gasoline here in our beloved Twin Cities. It's still up around $3.54, $3.59, $3.60. Talked to folks on both coasts of the United States, the East and West Coast, in some enclaves is up now approaching $5.
Yeah, I paid $3.80 this morning.
Oh, it hurts. It hurts when I hear you say that.
Yeah, and
$3.80?
Didn't even, Mr. Edwards, I was on E, $3.80. And I put $40 in, did not get to a half a tank.
Lord have mercy.
Yes.
Yeah, it's I'm looking at the body language and the demeanor of Americans right here in our Twin Cities, if you will. And I tell you, folks are very, very unhappy. They're trying to figure out what's going on. But I had a conversation, if I just share with our listening audience, about 20 minutes before we've gone on air. I stopped to get some gas. And a little young lady, they were asking for some kind of donation. I said, well, maybe when the price of your petrol goes down. And she was saying, yes, because the war in Libya. I said, no, it's not. Libya doesn't have anything to do with it. I said, you don't have any Libyan gasoline out there in those tanks. Libya provides less than 1% to the world market. And they've got these folks so messed up in their minds that folks do not understand what this is all about, Don Allen, is greed, profit, manipulation, and speculation. Okay? The speculators are there on the commodities market, as they call it. They're manipulating. You know, you now are buying gasoline that came from oil that was bought for $60 a barrel.
Yes.
A year and a half ago, 2 years ago. You know, if you know about the stock market. So anyways, but what the number, Mr. Allen, we can move into what's going on. We've got slave labor in Minnesota, buddy.
Yes, we do, and we're going to have to get into that. Mr. Edwards, you were just talking about the disasters over there in the Asian, Japan. And there's a website that I would like to advise all our listeners to check out. It's called PDC World Disaster Alerts. On the day before the American news even got the information, they showed earthquakes, tremors in Mexico, Hawaii, all across the globe. And it's a global map in real time. You're connected to the satellites that are in space. And
right.
The minute it happens, you get the real-time information on your computer.
Mm-hmm.
So just a pretty interesting, it's called PC.
Well, you're absolutely on point there because 2 days prior to the devastating 8.9 in northern Japan, there was about a 6.1 quake in that same general area. And folks know that area that's called the Ring of Fire, which is about 25,000 miles in scope, going from as far north as Russia, around Taiwan, all the way down to the Philippines, to Australia, New Zealand, and then through the South Pacific, up along the South American coast of Chile and Peru, Bolivia, Ecuador, Mexico. You know, people in L.A., in Los Angeles, and along the West Coast were shocked. They were given almost a 24-hour warning. I mean, so they had a chance for preparation, emergency preparation agency and everything. Still, you had casualties on the West Coast. You had waves coming in as high as 6 feet, and it just goes to show you the power of Mother Nature, buddy.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? Yeah, you know. Go ahead.
No, I just like to let everyone know. There's 14 minutes ago, there was a nuclear reactor emergency.
Again, another one?
Yes, another one right off the coast of Japan. And it's really strange, Mr. Edwards, because this particular program is accurate to within 800 feet. And I just zoomed in over here in Studio B. It's showing this nuclear reactor east of Japan in the middle of the sea.
You know what that is? I don't think that's a reactor, Don. I think that may be a nuclear sub.
That's a possibility.
I'm afraid that could be a nuclear sub that has come into some kind of contact or did with debris, because, you know, the nuclear subs can go deep,
yes.
But sometimes they're under what are called shelves and et cetera, and with the kind of turbulence and volatility in that part of the world, there's a possibility if a submarine, particularly a nuclear submarine, even running with radar and sonar, is not really watching and et cetera, there's a possibility. Now, if you're seeing something that say, because there are no nuclear facilities out in the off the Sea of Japan, but if you're seeing a nuclear alert and there's been a significant increase in radiation and et cetera, then we're talking about the possibility of a nuclear sub.
Yes.
Either U.S., Russian, but primarily it would be U.S. or Russian, if you will. That's not good.
No.
The United States has been rushing a significant amount of coolant into Japan in the last 20-some hours because you desperately need that coolant to get those rods and reactors cooled down. Well, the rods, it really is going to be your problem. And we have somewhat of a understanding of that, Mr. Allen, because we work for a utility company and are very cognizant of the whole nuclear program. In fact, we used to work for Northern States Fire Company. We had a situation back in the early 1970s that made all of us nervous. But, you know, the whole thing is to, you know, cover it up. But, again, I think that our listeners, those that have the electronic capability, need to check it out. Because if you're seeing a nuclear situation off the coast of Japan, somewhere out in the ocean, now we're talking about possibly a nuclear submarine.
Yes.
Yeah.
That right here, right now. So.
All right. Now, telephone number for our listeners, in case they wanted to come in, chit-chat with us as we talk in terms of what's going on up here on the plantation.
Yes, exactly. The call-in number, the toll-free number, is 877-572-4288. Again, that number is 877-572-4288. We invite you to call at any time during the show. And comments, suggestions, topics, we'll get into it with you. So,
yeah. All right. Let's get into our plantation. Three African-American activists at a meeting this past Thursday around 5:30 at the Minneapolis Public School District. And revelations, because you have some of the audio. Is that correct, Mr. Allen?
Yes, I do, Mr. Edwards.
Why don't you give our listening audience a little background as we'll discuss for the next number of minutes how slave labor works here in the Twin Cities.
Yes. Okay. What I have on, I have two audio clips. The first one I'm going to play is Ms. Lynn Littlejohn, who is the community outreach liaison for Mortenson Construction. And she's talking about the Networks for Better Future, which is a nonprofit organization that helps mostly men of color get back on their feet after they got out of prison.
Is that part of the reentry legislation?
Yes, that is part of the reentry.
Okay.
And so we'll get into, Mr. Edwards, we'll get in with our listening audience to further detail on that. But I think to set it up, we need to go ahead and play this first piece by Ms. Littlejohn.
Lynn Littlejohn. All right.
Here we go.
Minneapolis, it's in a nonprofit organization that helps kind of unemployed, underemployed men kind of turn their lives around. And they have kind of a workforce component, if you will, where they do salvage work. And we got the opportunity to meet them, kind of talk to them, and really try to find out if there was a way to be able to engage them in the project. And obviously, once the school buildings got emptied out, there was an opportunity to do some kind of salvage work before the demolition and before the abatement started. So they were able to come out and for I think about a two-week period of time do salvage in the schools before demolition started. So that was really the extent of their work. There was no contract with them. They were not paid by Mortenson Thor because they were able to retain whatever they brought out of the building and sell it. So that's how kind of it usually works with salvage firms. I mean, I think other projects we've done where we've done salvage, there has been no compensation from the general contractor to the salvage firm because what their compensation is the materials they are able to remove from the building in sale. So that is the typical practice. There was nothing done any differently with the network. So they were on site for a couple of weeks doing salvage, and then what you see in the workforce report is the number of hours that they worked for those two-week periods included in the workforce numbers. They, like I said, you do not see them included on in the WNBE participation summary because there was no business contract with them, what we just talked about, really in terms of being a good community neighbor, being an opportunity to engage them as a community organization on the project, and that's what we did.
Okay, Mr. Edwards.
Yes, sir. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just want to say now are these guys, and these are rhetorical questions, but I just want you to play along with me here for a quick minute.
Certainly.
Are these gentlemen from the Network for Better Futures being punished for a crime?
It appears that they are because let me just further amplify that they were, it was like them working in a penal colony. Mm-hmm. And let me say why. We were also, when I say we, the three individuals who raised questions during the public inquiry portion this past Thursday, Mr. Troy Parker, yourself, Mr. Allen, and yours truly here. We were present also on the 7th of December when Ms. Littlejohn of Mortensen made a similar presentation. In fact, during my inquiry, I encouraged the district to go back and listen to the transcript and the recording of her presentation, because on December 7th, 2010, she clearly enunciated the fact that these men were being compensated, and it was a part of a specific fiduciary relationship with Mortensen and the school district. And in fact, she opened her comments on December 7, 2010 to this same committee, which includes the, and we'll be getting to that I know later on, includes the city of Minneapolis's civil rights director. She clearly enunciated, she being Ms. Littlejohn, that these individuals were being fully compensated. The question came on December 7th, came from a gentleman by the name of Mr. Troy Parker, who was also present this past Thursday, and he asked the question with respect to the kind of compensation. Mortensen's representative indicated that prevailing wage was in place, that there was a relationship and a contract with the entity, which is affiliated with another very large nonprofit here in our community, and that everything was in order. Now, we currently have, as we sit here in studio, the document that was presented on Thursday, and a similar document which was presented on December 7th, 2010, in which Mortensen in the Minneapolis Public School District shows a document dealing with participation by organizations and particularly by racial groups. And let me just call our listening audience's attention to that particular document. Mr. Allen has a copy. I have a copy, in which it indicated that the business, the nonprofit that Mr. Allen identified a couple minutes ago, accumulated about 726 hours on this so-called salvage demolition piece. 726 hours were accumulated, in which 656.5 of those hours, 656.5 of those hours were worked by quote-unquote minorities, those minorities being the African-American men that Mr. Allen has just made reference to and that I maintain are a part of indentured slavery, as well as being part of a penal colony, as well as being punished, quote-unquote, for violations of societal norms, if you will. Bottom line is, Mr. Allen, these men work for less than, when you talk in terms of the scrap metal, because we've gone back at the National Research Institute and taken a look at what the going price was, and there's been a check of the records because the salvage companies make available certain information to the police because there's so much theft of copper and other kinds of metals here in the Twin Cities. And particularly when African-Americans, Mr. Allen, as you know, come in with what appears to be an abundance of particularly copper and other kinds of metals, they have to show identification, Social Security, and everything, and that's reported to the police. Well, we've been able to access back, and it appears that these men were paid about the equivalent of 50 cents an hour for their services, 50 cents an hour, based on 556.5 hours that they worked on the project. Okay?
Yes. And I want to I have a printer going here in the studio, Mr. Edwards, if that's what you hear in the background over there in your studio. I'm in Studio B, folks, and Mr. Edwards is Studio A here. But I just was like, to read you this. Now, Mortensen's Lynn Littlejohn and James Burrell, the Director of Diversity and Equity for the school district, said that, you know, this is wonderful. They were in celebration. These numbers was great.
Yes, they did.
This is the press release that the school district put out. Diverse business partners' goal exceed 20% for new Minneapolis Public Schools Education Service Center. They actually ran with these numbers, Mr. Edwards.
Yes, they did.
And those numbers were false, and I did alert them to that. But
now, wait a minute. You alerted them to that, Mr. Allen, on the 7th of December, because both you and Mr. Parker on the 7th of December, because what Miss Littlejohn's declaration was to the special committee, Oversight Committee for Diversity, which includes two sitting members now of Minneapolis Board of Education, she said specifically that as an outgrowth of the employment of these men, these slave laborers, that they had already achieved 45% participation by minorities on the project, starting with demolition. Am I correct, Mr. Allen? Because we have required and asked the district to make public the tape of that meeting of December 7th.
Yes.
She said 45%. In fact, what happened in this meeting on this past Thursday, Velma Corvell, who is a co-conspirator in this situation, the director of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department, there apparently had been a prior discussion between Ms. Corvell, Ms. Littlejohn, and Mr. Burroughs and others at the Minneapolis Board of Education. They had anticipated that we may show up, though everything was done to make sure that we didn't, but we were there. And they had had a pre-discussion about how Ms. Littlejohn was going to respond to the question from Director Corvell about the discrepancy that had been uncovered by all three of us during the last 3 months. All right? Am I correct?
You are correct.
And what happened was Ms. Corvell, director of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department, who sat there and heard this violation of current statutes, if you will, tried to run a scam by asking the question and asking Ms. Littlejohn to clarify the discrepancies in the number, though technically Ms. Littlejohn had already completed her formal presentation to the special committee, which is comprised of a minister of a leading church, the two sitting school board members, Velma Corvell, the head of the St. Paul Human Rights Department, who I now understand specifically did not come to the meeting because she did not want to be a part of the sham. And I repeat that again. The head of the St. Paul Civil Rights Department, who sits on the panel, decided not to come to the meeting because she, in good conscience and for reasons of stewardship, did not want to be involved in that. Okay, and this is very, very disturbing because you had African American men who are under the custody and control of the state as well as the nonprofits that they have been assigned to by the state of Minnesota's Department of Corrections, who were forced into slave labor or forced labor.
Yes. And
it's as simple, as that.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with you 100%. But now there's another piece. And for our listening domestic and international audience, I'd like to say that, you know, I am not an attorney. I am not a lawyer, but I could probably play one on TV. But after further research, you have to, in this particular case, for the men and the total, I think it was of 728 hours, she said, and then she adjusted to 658. She said a couple of things, and we'll play another clip in a minute. But the Minnesota Constitution, Article 1, Bill of Rights, Section 2, titled Rights and Privileges, says, "No member of this state shall be disenfranchised or deprived of any of the right or privileges secured to a citizen thereof unless by law of the land or judgment of his peers. There should be neither slavery nor involuntary servitude in the state other than punishment for a crime with the party has been convicted." Okay? So to me, Mr. Edwards, as I comprehend that, these men were used as indentured servants, in indentured servitude, as like slaves in modern-day society, and I think they are owed, and this is a heinous oversight and puts the Minneapolis Public School Board, the directors, in straight liability for this particular heinous incident.
And that is absolutely correct. And for those, and I've already received calls over the last couple of days, there were people who actually were listening to the live broadcast, and they have clearly enunciated to yours truly that they are concerned that Ms. Corvell is an example. Once the declaration was made and once the documentation was shown to be inconsistent with what had been published and certified, that Ms. Corvell actually had a statutory requirement, an obligation, the key word is obligation, a statutory obligation to have immediately excused and extricated herself from the panel, and to have made formal inquiry the next day, which would have been Friday, yesterday, with respect to clarification, even though she was a part of playing the game, all right?
Yes.
She sat there. She never expressed any concern about the inconsistency. And by the way, the document that we are, that Mr. Allen and myself on this program are reading from, and earlier I made the statement that the information being given by Ms. Littlejohn on this past Thursday, the 10th of March 2011, was somewhat, at best, inconsistent with her testimony on December 7th, 2010. The document we're reading from is called the Minneapolis Public Schools Educational Service Center Project. But here's what's important for our listening audience, Mr. Allen. The document subtitle is Workforce Utilization Summary, 3-4-2011. Now, I don't know what kind of scam these folks think that they're playing. This workforce summary document has been filed with the Department of Labor prior to the meeting on Thursday as a quote-unquote expression of success. You talked about that just minutes ago. And a certification and authentication of workforce participation. The only thing is they forgot to point out that in the case of the entity identified as the network, that 658 hours, I mean, we'll just go with the official piece, out of 728, 658 hours was slave labor.
Hey, Mr. Edwards.
Yes.
I have Mr. Troy Parker here on actual speakerphone. He actually got my cell. And Mr. Parker, hello and welcome to the show. Okay, can you hear him, Mr. Edwards?
Just barely, but why don't you just repeat it and listen and move it along, because Mr. Parker was a key
yeah.
person in bringing this information out.
Mr. Parker, it probably might be better if you call us at 877-572-4288, and then we'll patch you right in, because you were one of the key people there at the meeting on Thursday, and we're getting ready to get in the... Okay, no problem. It's 877-572-4288.
4288?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And just follow the instructions, and you'll be right at the switchboard. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Good. It'd be good
I apologize about that, Mr. Edwards. I had called him earlier because he was there, and I was going to get into the Davis Bacon and the prevailing wages piece. That is
absolutely.
Guys, and Mr. Parker understands that explicitly. So...
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll give him a couple minutes here, and we'll wait for him to call in. But, yeah, I was really shocked, and I didn't mean to cut you off there, Mr. Everton.
No, go right in.
I was just really shocked that Friday, March 11th at 3:25 p.m. that I received this email from the Minneapolis Public Schools Communications Department, which says, diverse business partner goals exceeded by 20% for new Minneapolis Public School Educational Service Center. And I said, wait a minute. These people, Bishop Howe, Councilmember Don Samuels, Ron Hicks, Craig Taylor from the Office of Business and Community Economic Development, the University of Minnesota, Louise Maria Freyas from the Director of Human Rights in St. Paul, Velma Corbell, Civil Rights, and Alberto Mazzarate from he's a board member, and Rebecca Gagnon.
Who's
a board member also. I mean, Mr. Edwards, they all going to have to take a really close look here. I mean, people say, okay, that Mr. Edwards, that Ron and Don show, Troy, all these people, they're agent provocateurs. Here we go right here. We have him. Mr. Parker.
Yes.
You're live on the air. I was just telling Mr. Edwards that, you know, we went to this meeting on Thursday, and on Friday at 3:25 p.m., I received a press release from the district that says diverse business partners goal exceeded by 20% for the new Minneapolis Public School Education Service Center. Is that correct, Mr. Parker?
Well, I'm not exactly sure of the actual figures or what the goal was. I mean, I guess if you set the goal, you have the ability to exceed it if that's where your goal is set. It's all dependent on how you set the goal. My main concern is about how much money actually went to the community in question.
Yeah. Go ahead, please.
Well, I mean, that's just my whole focus and intent on it, is when you're talking about developing a community and you're saying that this is one of the key components, to provide economic opportunity to this community. And then when we have 728 man hours logged by individuals from this community and they don't receive $1 of compensation, then I have an issue with that.
And this was pointed out by Mr. Parker, and the actual number under the minority category was 585 that we've mentioned a number of times now. Mr. Parker had pointed out on Thursday that 585 hours of participation by persons of color represents a significant financial insertion into the community. Now, I well remember back in December, gentlemen, that at one point, as she was talking about the excellent numbers, she used the reference of at least in excess of 20 African-American males that were involved. And I remember all of us kind of looking at each other because nobody seen any African-Americans over there. And Mr. Allen has been going over there faithfully with his tricorder and recording. But, you know, even at $10 an hour, gentlemen, even at non-prevailing wage, you know, 558 hours, I mean, that's a lot of money that should have been left in this community. Mr. Parker, what is your understanding of what the prevailing wage should have been in this situation?
Well, first, I do not want to stop with the 558 labor hours. There were 728 total hours by the network. Well, them 728, 558 may be minus administration, but the administration hours would have went to this community as well if another contractor would have received that contract or would have been awarded that contract. So we have to take that contract in its totality, which was 728 man hours, and I know the total package of any trade nowadays would exceed $60 to $75 per hour totally. So that's
okay.
Quite a bit of money that we're talking about. We're talking about over $50,000 in compensation in a 3-month period.
Almost $60,000. Yeah. By the way, we did not see a document presented to us, though we had to ask on a couple of different occasions to see the same documents that they were providing to the so-called oversight committee. I have yet to see a document which indicates what the actual dollar payout was. Have either of you gentlemen seen that?
No, I have not seen it.
Yeah.
Well,
because,
well,
Mr. Parker, that goes to the issue that you have raised, just how much money was left with community.
So, I mean, we're looking at this here, and if you Google Minnesota Davis-Bacon wage determination by state, and you go to Minnesota, I think they updated, Mr. Parker, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they look at this each year because it was last updated December 24th, 2010, and for construction-type building in Hennepin County in Minnesota, this does not include single-family homes or apartments, but the dollar amount that Mr. Parker gave for laborers is absolutely correct. Plus, when we first listened to Ms. Littlejohn, before you got here, Mr. Parker, we listened to a cut or tape from Ms. Littlejohn, and she made it seem as though that salvage companies don't get paid for salvaging.
Well, here's how we first have to address the issue. If Mortenson bid, which I would assume because they demoed the rest of the building, included demolition of that building, then that building was part of the initial contract award to Mortenson Construction, which then falls under the Davis-Bacon prevailing wage law and scale.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not in a certified indentured apprentice, then you must receive journeyman wages.
Mm-hmm.
This is federal
mm-hmm.
law.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, we do not have the ability or the opportunity to decide when and where we're going to separate portions of that contract out and disregard the law that regulates these type of projects. We have to follow that law all the way through that entire project. And I know that total award package included demolition.
Yeah. We talked about that on this program 8 months ago, but go ahead. Yeah. Well, what do you feel that the district's liability, because the district technically is the builder, though they're not going to be the owner of the facility, and we already know that, and that's just a non-debatable issue. But where do you think the liability lies here?
Well, I haven't seen all the total documents or whatever that oversees this entire contract, but
mm-hmm.
they also have a committee that is they have charged with the duties of overseeing this construction project. So that committee, in some way, shape, or form, has to find out what happened. But ultimately, the court would determine what happens if the people are not compensated, because according to federal law, you don't just refund back the money that was not paid to these individuals. You have to refund that total contract price of that entire project. So we're
And then they're also money. And then there are also penalties and sanctions that normally the court will impose for the violation, and particularly in this case of federal law. Now, we had an enforcement. We have on the committee that you're talking about, and Mr. Allen has already named the roster, including Bishop Howe of Shiloh and et cetera, Craig Taylor, University of Minnesota, et cetera. But we had a very important person who sits on this committee also, and that is the chief enforcement officer for civil and contract law here in the city of Minneapolis, Velma Corvell. Were you surprised, Mr. Parker, that she did not absent herself or withdraw immediately when it became clear that these African Americans had worked and not been compensated, not been paid?
Well, I guess I'm not really sure what the issues were surrounding that, and I'm not going to try to even speculate on what they're going to do moving forward. I guess the real question or issue is, what is the community going to do? Are we going to drop the ball on it, or are we going to pursue it and make sure that these questions are answered?
Well, but you understand that now we go back now to the original creation, which we talked about on this program way back in the late summer. The district maintains that it has created a community entity, and that is the committee that we sat there looking at for the second time. And by the way, they only meet once every 3 months. That committee we were looking at allegedly is the representation and the voice of the community. So how do you feel? What do you suggest as a strategy on how we get them off their keisters?
Well, I recommended that they have a committee that would include some members of the community, but that hasn't happened. So what is the next step is for the community to create their own committee and actually oversee the committee that the school appointed and oversee the project and make sure that it's carried out according to federal and local regulations, but also make sure that the benefit that the community was guaranteed is therefore given to the community.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, on that particular point, as you know, on the agenda Thursday was a matter that talked in terms, well, first of all, the heading under sub 4 was community participation public inquiry. And they also had a, under B, they had a reference to Troy Parker questions. But before that, under A, they had community benefits agreement. And a community benefits agreement had been submitted also back in December. And Mr. Burroughs has basically told the principal point person, who is, in fact, Mr. Allen, my co-host here, that initially he said Thursday morning the decision would be made to either vote up or down the community benefits agreement. Of course, as we all know, it didn't happen. Is that something that you're talking about? Because when you start talking in terms of imposing a community entity, into the formal business structure of a construction project, the district's going to have to sign off on that unless you're able to find some people who are ready to go to court and try to get a restraining order.
I guess I didn't understand. What is your question?
The question is, how do you accomplish what it is that you just proposed? I mean, I think it's an excellent proposal that there be a real community-oriented oversight committee. That's the actual appropriate term. But how do you do that? Because the courts are going to rule that the actual agent, fiduciary, and otherwise, legally, for this project and for any decisions as it pertains to the supervision of the project has to be made by the special school district board of directors. And that though there are two members on there, we all know that they are unfortunately non-voting, which I never could understand, Mr. Allen, Mr. Parker. how two school board members could sit on a committee with that kind of responsibility and be designated by James Burroughs as non-voting. I think that was a disaster and a poor decision. But my question to you is, how do you get entree? How do you get yourself positioned to do what you just proposed?
Well, first, let's step back when you discuss the committee. Mr. Burroughs is not a member of the committee, so therefore Mr. Burroughs cannot make any rules or regulations that govern the committee.
I understand what you're saying, but he has been.
Okay,
he has been
so the
that.
Committee has to make their own rules and regulations. So that's the first point. The second point is all federal money has a clause or usually has something in it, the legislation that says it has to be done in conjunction with the community, and they have to hold a series of public meetings and get the community's input. And if you do not feel that is what's happening, then we have to address that. But you also must really keep in mind that on March 30th, if we have the governor come into town, and I'm sure some state funds are being used as well, well, that would be a great question or issue to bring up to the governor that day.
Well, that would be a good question. And are you one of the ones? Have you been RSVP'd or have you been certified to speak and raise questions?
Well, I received a letter, but, you know, I got certified to speak when I started paying taxes when I turned 18. So
okay.
I didn't need an invitation to speak to any public official that I've elected or that represent me, whether I voted for them or not, that holds an office. So I don't need an invitation to address any elected official, and neither does anyone else in our community. So
okay.
If we do not show up and speak freely and speak and say that we are the people, and
mm-hmm.
that we have the right to speak to our elected official, then
mm-hmm.
that is just as much our problem as theirs.
Oh, agreed. I definitely agree. I think Mr. Allen agrees.
Yeah, I agree.
But that, unfortunately, has not been happening. An example of that, as you know, Mr. Parker, was what happened Thursday when only three community people showed up in a meeting in which the district is saying they sent out notifications over a month ago. That's what they said. But Mr. Allen, any questions on your side? Because I think this has been an excellent discussion.
Yeah, I know. That's enough for me. I mean, I agree with Mr. Parker's last statement about this this invite to this Twin City Economic Summit. But you know, we just gotta have to go and get the community motivated and get them up there any way we can. So.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, I think we want to thank Mr. Parker for sharing his insight with us, so we have an idea. Hopefully some of our leadership will be speaking to this. We certainly have enough meetings going on. I just hope that folks would be concerned enough about the fact that black men have been required to work on a major project and were never compensated.
Well, Mr. Edwards, I also have part two of the Mortensen.
Let's play it while we still have Mr. Parker on the air.
Okay.
$16 million worth of work that we actually have bought out so far on the project, and about $7 million of that has been committed to women and minority-owned firms for participation of 45% against that $16 million that's been procured. So we are still awarding work. We have taken all of the proposals for all of the work to be done on the project, but we are still evaluating those proposals and making awards. So we really do anticipate that as we complete buyout, that we will increase and have additional participation both for minority businesses and female businesses. So I feel good about where we are, and they're still just kind of not resting on our laurels, saying, okay, we've kind of, you know, achieved or exceeded the goals, but still continuing to maximize the participation throughout the rest of the buyout of the project, and pretty strongly that there are additional opportunities for more women and minority-owned firms to be involved in the project on the rest of the work to be awarded. And then on the workforce.
And that was Ms. Lynn Littlejohn, community liaison for Mortensen Construction, talking about the dollar amounts and who they were dedicated to, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So,
now, here's a question I need to ask. Maybe, Mr. Parker, maybe you can help us here on point.
Mr. Parker has he had to excuse himself.
Okay, well, then we'll any other callers want to call in, feel free to give us a call. This is the question we asked ourselves here on Point, Mr. Allen and I in our discussion, because I was going to ask Mr. Parker if he could, you know, give us some insight into what he thought Lynn Littlejohn was saying. I know what I think she was saying, and so I'll use the time that we control to do that. Mr. Allen, I'm puzzled because she was talking about the continued involvement of the community, and then you have another piece there, by the way, where she talked in terms of a meeting at UROC in a couple of weeks in which the community will be brought up to speed and familiarized with how to get involved in some of the additional contracts. Now, here's the fact. When the Minneapolis Special School District almost a year ago approved the contract for the construction of the Crystal Palace, as I call it, at along the 1200 block of West Broadway, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the law says that all contracts must be committed to, certified, and etched in stone, if you will. Now, she's talking as if this is a piecemeal kind of contract. And so I'm puzzled about how anyone is going to be able to get inclusion in this if one talks in terms of, and this is a key word, unfortunately, for all of us, contract law, okay? If you're talking about the adherence to contract law, particularly by a institution which is a public institution, that's Minneapolis Special School District, which operates off the tax dollars of the citizens of Minneapolis as well as, you know, other kinds of contributions and et cetera from the federal and state government, why is she still talking about the opportunity to get a piece of the pie? I thought the pie was spoken for. Am I incorrect, Mr. Allen?
Oh, no, you're not incorrect at all. That's just not the case. She's doing her own thing, and they're flying by their own seat of their pants. But, you know, in the very beginning, she says, okay, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. But now it turns out that, you know, we're going to show you how to do this now. In mid-project, basically.
Now, there is another document that also, I mean, we were trying to be kind of kind here at On Point, maybe even a little clever, but we'll go ahead and have to do it because we're not hearing the kind of information. Now, there is a document also given out that really, because Mr. Allen, my associate here, insisted we be given copies, and we were then joined by Director Gaglin, who realized what was happening. I mean, the dollar figures are all here in play. The WMBE goal is at $6 million, okay? The W/MBE participation to date, I mean, the figure here says $7,166,659, and that was the 45% figure, and that's the figure that Velma Corvell tried to saber on by indicating that figure was not correct. I want to repeat that again because Mr. Parker raised the question and unfortunately said he had not seen this information. But I'm looking at a document certified by Mortensen. It carries its heading as well as the heading of 4. And by the way, I don't see any heading dealing with Legacy. Wasn't Legacy a co-developer of this project?
Well, Legacy was in it for 40%.
Yeah, but I have a document here that shows Mortensen Thor, but it doesn't show Legacy. But anyways, the document, maybe this was an accident. Maybe it's a typo. But I repeat again, this document says the WMBE goal would be $6 million, 25%. You see, my friends, this goes to the heart of what we said a couple of minutes ago, 20 minutes ago, when Lynn Littlejohn on the 7th of December was talking about the success, and they were patting themselves on the back, and if they'd had champagne there, they would have been drinking it. When she said, we're already at 45% of the MBE. See, she didn't also say goals. She said monetary participation, Mr. Allen. Go back and listen to the tape. Now, this document, which we have in our hands, Mr. Burroughs and them are going to have a heck of a time getting this document out of your hand and my hand. They maintain that as of Thursday, they had already spent $7,166,659, 45% of the so-called financial cost with women and minority business enterprises. Now, can you explain to me how that happened?
No, I'm looking at the same document. I'm not feeling it. I'm not seeing it. And if it doesn't come out on the calculator, it's not true.
Yeah. Well, like I said, for those that maintain that, you know, Don and Ron are, you know, spreading a lot of poison and being negative and et cetera, I mean, we have to address this. Oh, by the way, just kind of an aside note, there's also an issue with respect to Buy American. We won't even go into that. We'll let somebody ask us about it, but it's on the record, if you will. You know, there's a serious question about one of the most important elements, Mr. Allen, in the construction of the building, and that is the steel. And wasn't it, I felt bad for Ms. Littlejohn. Ms. Littlejohn did not know where the steel for the building is to come from.
Yep. it set it back because they didn't have a clue, Mr. Edwards. They did not have a clue.
And I was so sad about that because I thought that the importance of specificity was one of the things that Mr. Burroughs and the district sold to the community back last fall and late last summer when they said that this oversight committee is going to be put in place because we're sick and tired of hearing people like Don Allen and Ron Edwards maligning us and blasting us and making inconsistent and untrue statements. So this committee is going to be put in place and is going to oversee this. And remember they also said the committee was going to report quarterly to the community?
Yes.
Well, let me see now. The committee came up for business in October, which was supposed to be the commensurate date of the demolition. They really didn't get started until November, right? Have we had an annual report from the committee itself?
No, nothing.
To the community, I mean?
No, nothing to the community.
Okay. I was just wondering, because this has been such a success story, and you know, based on the documents that they are providing. These are not documents made up by Don and Ron here on Point. These are documents that have been crafted, if you will, and disseminated. Because, see, I understand what Mr. Parker said, but we are aware that these are the kind of documents that are being given, to the governor's office to talk about how well things are economically in the black community. Mm-hmm. Now, let's spend a little time, Mr. Allen, if you could. What is this meeting I'm hearing people talking about? There's going to be a big economic meeting, economic development meeting with our newly elected governor. First time in 30 years or thereabouts that a governor of the state of Minnesota has really come into the community of color and really talked in terms of the economic opportunities for those people. What is this meeting about? And I did ask Mr. Parker a question, and I was not being, you know, snide, because I understand that there's a group called presenters, who have already been pre-designated, and they will ask whatever questions are deemed to be appropriate to be asked to Governor Mark Dayton. By the way, have you received an invitation, Mr. Allen?
Well, I just happened to have the email that was sent out by State Representative Jeff Hayden, who's looking to be a private citizen in 2013. The invitation says, "Dear community leader, it is heartfelt. It's with heartfelt enthusiasm that we extend an invitation for you to join Governor Mark Dayton, Representative Champion, Representative Hayden, Representative Moran, Senator Harrington, Educational Commissioner Brenda Casillas,
Casillas,
Higher Education Director Sheila Wright, Human Resource Commissioner Kevin Lindsay, Transportation Commissioner Thomas Sorrell, Department of Employment and Economic Development Commissioner Mark Phillips, Reverend McAfee, and a cross-section of community leaders for an economic summit in North Minneapolis."
Okay. Now, in that you know, have been invited to come up on the mount, if you will. And by the way, have they indicated the site? Is it going to be UROC? Because I understand there's some kind of battle going on. Some want it at North High School, where a reasonable number of community people can actually access, as opposed to UROC, in which I understand that some of our political leaders have said that we want it as in a smaller place as possible, a private property, so that we could control the activities and the agenda. Now, where is this meeting to be?
The Economic Summit will take place on March 30th, 2011, from 3:30 to 5 p.m. at the University of Minnesota's Research and Outreach Center, UROC, 2001 Plymouth Avenue North.
3:30 to 5?
Yes.
That's an hour and a half by the way that the black crow flies, right?
Yeah, an hour and a half to have a economic summit.
Okay. Yeah. So I imagine we'll get a lot of things in, a lot of questions to be asked, and I assume we'll have a lot of answers, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so.
That's ridiculous.
Okay, so an hour and a half meeting with the governor, in which you are expecting maybe as many as 100 leaders. Will this be similar to the meeting they had with then gubernatorial candidate Mark Dayton in, September of 2010, in which many of our leaders indicated that it was a closed meeting?
Yes. They had the Minneapolis Urban League.
Okay. Is the Urban League on the doo-doo list? Why did they go back over to the Urban League?
I don't know. I mean, I have no idea. I mean, the Urban League doesn't have microphones and a sound system, but neither does UBOT. So, I mean, it's a toss-up,
Okay. Whereas they do have a sound system in North High School, because I was just there for a meeting as they selected the firm that will do the redesign of North High School. So I know they have a system there and everything. But just give me your thinking. I mean, as an old-timer, and of course, certainly not one who would ever be on the invite list, I'm just trying to get a feel on what will be accomplished, what will be the outcome. Will this be like the meeting at General Mills a couple years ago with Gary Cunningham and the Northwest Area Foundation?
Yes. Mr. Edwards, this is exactly a dummy's guide to economic development in the black community. This is nothing more than window dressing with elitist black politicians that have changed from being public servants to event planners. Okay? That's what they are. They have no clue about the significant needs of the community other than to put on a good face for the masses. This is nothing in-depth where you can go behind the scenes and actually have that four-hour board meeting with Governor Dayton and say, hey, Governor Dayton, these are the issues. This is a plan. I want you to look at it. Let's try to do something here. This is totally superficial, Mr. Edwards. This is 100% superficial, window dressing. Representative Champion and Hayden are showing that, we can bring the governor here, we can bring him here, and there's no substance to this at all whatsoever.
Well, that's really sad in light of the story that we're breaking here on Point. I've heard no one challenged, and we won't have, one caller, but the caller was also a participant, so they can say that we all have a vested interest, maybe even a conflict of interest, though I don't think you really have a conflict of interest when you're dealing with the truth. But, we just had a situation that we uncovered here on this program as a part of our participation in country, if you will, boots on the ground, in which we found something that, has not been a part of the Minnesota structure since the 1850s. I mean, that's indentured servitude and slavery. I mean, not since, the Dred Scott case, which, by the way, came out of Fort Snelling, the military base right here in South Minneapolis. And, am I off base here, Mr. Allen, that it's kind of acceptable, it's okay to take black men and women if that's needed and work them for no wages at all on a $37 million project, and folks are making all kinds of profit and Mortensen's going to walk away with at least $1 million in profit and Catalyst. Oh, see, we haven't talked about those entities that we have been highlighting on these programs since May. I mean, is it just something we should just close our eyes to? I mean, give me some guidance here.
Well, I think that we should look around. Mr. Edwards, there's a lot of things going on. There's a lot of training going on. And people aren't getting their share of what they work for. By no means, it's like this. In the corporate world, in the white corporate world, they don't care. If you're a prisoner, I don't care. I mean, any of that stuff. But if you get a job with a company and they assign you to a task, there is an understanding that this is a job or work as defined by job or work, not only in the dictionary, but by the company's SOP, Standard of Operating Procedures.
Absolutely.
You get paid for that.
You get. Let me repeat this. I know it sounds redundant. You get paid. You receive remunerations. You receive compensation. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. These gentlemen are due compensation.
Okay, because allegedly, I'd say this in the proper context, In 1863, there was a document called the Emancipation Proclamation.
Mm-hmm.
A group of people called Negroes, a race in America, were allegedly set free. Am I correct?
You are correct.
Though we know historically that there was a involvement of slavery by another name, but we all were told, our ancestors were told that we were free.
Yes.
Now, here's what's so troubling. You and I on this program have talked since the introduction of the study, and I'm talking about the first study that came out of Washington, D.C., that talked in terms that black folk do not get employment in Minnesota. And then the disparity study came out. And before that, there was an excellent study by a young lady, a young research assistant at the University of Minnesota. We've had three separate studies in which no one has really challenged the authenticity, the accurateness, and et cetera of it, which says that black folk are paid at least 40% less than white folks and others for similar work and et cetera, right?
Yes.
Now we have deteriorated to the place here in Minnesota where African-American men during the month of November, December, and some parts of January, November, December 2010, January 2011, were forced to work for no wages whatsoever. They were told that they could take some of the scraps, materials, and et cetera, and if they could get a fair price, whatever that's supposed to mean, which, as we said earlier, we found out through researching some information that these men were ultimately paid the equivalent of about 50 cents an hour based on the salvage material that they were allowed to take from the site. Okay? And should that not bother us, or is it just that we just say, hey, it's okay?
No, that's not okay at all. And I'm looking in the chat room, and there's several people there, and there's about 300 or 400 people here locally in the Twin Cities currently listening to this show. And I'm absolutely shocked that no one will pick up a phone and dial 877-572-4288. This is not only about us, but this is about the future of what's going on here in the Twin Cities. I mean, these are people, some of you look like me. So the politicians that look like me are actually running you over, not addressing your needs, and you get up in the morning sometimes, some of you, decide between gas and food. You know, it takes 2 weeks in some cases. You might make, you know, $1,500 a week, but you're living check to check.
Mm-hmm.
I said, this is absolutely ridiculous. You know, you need to call in and speak up. And if you don't want to call up, call Bobby Joe Champion on Monday. Call State Representative Jeff Hayden.
Call Superintendent Bernadier Johnson. Yes. Call Board Director Jill Davis. Call members of the Minneapolis School Board. At least, my God, at least have the courage to at least make inquiry. Prove us wrong.
Yeah.
If that's the tenor of the conversation that Ron and Don and a collaboration of guys or young ladies have made up this, you know, at least go out for your own edification. Go out and at least, my God, ask the question. I mean, listening audience, we have a situation here where African-American men were forced to work on a $37 million project for no compensation. They were told that they could gather up the scraps that they could pick up with their own hands. They weren't even allowed to remove the materials with a truck and then take them down the street to 4th Street. Some of y'all know where the salvage yards are. You see black people going in there, man, with push carts and et cetera, trying to sell materials and salvage so that they can try to eat and keep their head above water. My God, Twin Cities, where are you at?
Yeah, really. And, you know, and when you get into the school, you know, you have to know where the decisions are made. When you call the school board or you're trying to find out where the public school decisions are made, it's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, a six-tier process.
Okay? You're right.
Okay? You start with Congress. Congress trumps everything. Then you have our state legislators.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the school board. Okay. Then you have the superintendent. Then you have the principal of each school, and then you have the teachers. There's a tremendous burden being put on the teachers right now.
And, yes, it is.
And we have to look at that because their principals are telling them, well, that's what the board says. And then their superintendents are telling them, well, that's what the board says. Right. But no one's reaching past that superintendent or that school board to look at the state legislators or the Congress, a congressperson that can make those decisions that changes the plight of African-American students or all students in the public school systems around the country. So you have a lot of this craziness going on here in Minneapolis and in Twin Cities in general, and you don't have people addressing it. You know, 20 years ago, how could two rookie legislators get away with bringing the governor of a state into a black community for the first time elected and only invite a handful of people and have it in a room that barely holds 150 people?
I guess people just don't feel that it's important that those kinds of questions be asked. You know, I want to ask this question, too. I wonder how many of the African-American men who were forced to work in indentured servitude, if you will, I wonder how many of them were violated and are now back in the penitentiary because they were not able to partake in any of the benefits that their conditions of parole and probation required them. And see, many of these men, by the way, told their PO officers that they were working, okay? And in some cases, some of those men were involved in situations where they had to make restitution. See, we haven't even talked about that. And they had no money to make restitution, and some of them were violated and sent back to the penitentiary because their probation officers initially thought that they were shucking and jiving. But then the political consequences came into play when these government officials, probation officers, found out that these men had been required to work for no compensation. And so what we did is just swept it under the rug. And some of these men that we talked about that worked this 580-some hours, 560 hours, if you will, these men had been sent back to the penitentiary.
Yeah. And yes. Ms. Harris, you just hit on something really great and important. Just think if one of those men says, no, I should get paid for doing this and was violated and sent to the penitentiary.
And I'm not so sure that this sounds like you got a call.
Yeah, no, that was another
call. Oh, I thought maybe someone would. Well, my understanding is that probably is what's happened.
And
someone made a by the way, who the company we've been talking about, we've stayed away from. Who is the fiduciary agent for this business that made these slaves available, forced labor available to the school?
What's that? Who is
fiduciary agent?
The fiduciary agent would be Hire Minnesota, from what I understand. I'm not totally sure on that because that has bounced around because I did think
Ooh.
That. I think
Hire Minnesota. Wow.
I do think they got their 501c3 designation, so they would no longer need a fiduciary agent, if I'm not mistaken. But I have a list of questions for the Network for Better Futures and their executive director. I don't know who it is right now, but it has changed significantly. I know they had some more people hired on that were released from LISC that actually have hired on with the network and Hire Minnesota and things like that. So I want to call first thing Monday morning and figure out if I can get to the bottom of this because you have a serious violation of federal law in this instance on the district headquarters and those people working those, like Mr. Parker, till 728 hours and not getting any compensation. Now, here goes the catch 22.5. If there were supervisors, Mr. Edwards?
But see, that's what I want to cut in. That's what they were. I didn't want to cut Mr. Parker off. The 70 or 60 some hours that you would subtract from the 728 off of the 658, those were white supervisors. See, our forced labor was supervised by white overseers.
Wow.
And apparently those white overseers worked for Hire Minnesota.
Interesting.
That's the explanation. I thought that folks would see that. When you talk about, because the 728 number is in the category of total participation, The 658 is for minority participation, and it was for those African-American men that were identified by Miss Littlejohn and others on December 7th, a day that will live in infamy, if you will, in this town, and repeated again until the game started being played because the numbers weren't matching up. And I repeat again, the documents we retrieved on this past Thursday indicates that 45% of the monies have already been awarded, quote-unquote, to minority contractors.
Yes.
I'm looking at the list like you are. Those are not minority contractors on this list.
No, they're not. No, they're not.
Gabbard's not a minority contractor.
No, not at all.
You know.
Not at all.
What's called Elevator is not a minority contractor. I mean, come on, you know. And then we had the chief enforcement officer for the city of Minneapolis and also James Burroughs for the district, but the most important person, and Velma Corvell sat there as a co-conspirator.
There she did.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The only bona fide minority contractor that is on the site, and they have an amount of $696,969, which is an interesting number, is, of course, our good friends, Thor Construction.
Yes.
Richard Copeland. Okay?
Oh, yeah.
Horowitz is not a minority. Gaffard is not a minority. Buss is not a minority. Everbate is not a minority. Rachel Contracting. And clearly, I can tell you this, and clearly the steel company is not a minority.
Mr. Evers, we have a call.
Oh, good, good. Let them bring them in.
You're live on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. This is Mustafa calling from Minneapolis.
Hey, Mustafa. How are you doing?
Good, good, good. I was listening to you guys talking about the contracting with Minneapolis schools.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that much about it, but I know so many people who are mostly East African immigrants do transportation business, and I know they never give them any contract. I know who they give the contract. They give companies own it and run by corrupted white people who don't even have business in Minneapolis, but other cities like New Hope, and they deny the contract, you know, because, and they take all the money and they give them whatever they decide, you know, nobody, because they know the ones who are signing the contract, you know, and I am planning to investigate a little bit more about that and find out who decides, and it's not just the school board and but even the contractor rebuilding Cedar Riverside high rises, that they say we will give the community, you know, a chance to they said we will provide employment. You know, that was part of the when they were trying to get the money from the government, and as soon as they get the money, they forget about it. And all they had an organization who were. Who were claiming that they will make sure, like RISE, R-I-S-E, I think it's some kind of non-profit organization, but they never hired anybody or don't plan to hire anybody from the community or the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Absolutely correct, Mustafa. In fact, there was quite a bit of that, as you know, when they were building the light rail from downtown to the airport. Both the East African community, the Native American community, were promised all kinds of dreams, if you will, that included significant participation, contract awards of up to 8, 9, 12, 13% of the contracts, and et cetera. And I think, as you know, and we certainly all know here at On Point, it never happened. It never happened. There was no enforcement by the Civil Rights Department, by the State Human Rights Department, by anyone, and basically people such as yourself and others who complain, your complaints were thrown in the waste paper basket or shredded, and we have politicians of all colors and persuasions walking around talking in terms of happy days, yet no one can make anybody else understand why there's all this economic hardship in all of our respective communities, because when you talk about the amount of money that folks say that has been infused into the communities of color, we should be doing pretty good. And I do not understand all these folks that I see who are in shelters and et cetera and homeless in this town or can't meet their obligations, et cetera. And Masafa, Mr. Allen, I'm just trying to figure out, as an old brother, I'm just trying to figure out where the money went.
Stand by. We have another call. We're bringing him in with all of us. Hold on.
All right.
Yes, go ahead, caller. You're live on the air. Hello? 0737, you're live on the air. Go ahead.
What's that number again?
The number here, it's the last four is 0737.
Anyways, well, obviously they couldn't get through. By the way, I want to clarify something while we have it. We're down to about 13 minutes, Mr. Allen.
Yes, yes. About 13 minutes.
A series of questions were asked by Mr. Parker way back in December. Actually, this document was slipped into the materials that were given to us. Its heading is New Educational Service Center Minority Women Participants Questions and Answers from Troy Parker. You know, even contrary to what our friend Troy said, in their response to him under number two and number three, what were the contract dollar amounts, if any, and what wage rate did the workers receive? Martinson and the school district says none. You know, they said there were no goals set. You remember that?
Yeah.
And yet the document that we have that is entitled and has the heading Martinson 4 and is the property now of the Minneapolis Public Schools says, I repeat it again for the fourth time, the WMBE, that's Women Minority Business Enterprise goal, was $6 million, 25%. They maintain that the women MBE participation to date, the word participation, as I understand it in Webster's dictionary, means a formal activity, right?
Yes.
That has taken place. $7,166,659, 45%. So even in their response to Mr. Parker, they lied.
Exactly.
They lied. I mean, they outright lied. We have the document here in hand, here on point, these questions that were asked by Mr. Parker that it took him 4 months to get back to him on. But in the course of doing that, they just that was a total misrepresentation. And, you know, so but anyways, is Masafa still with us?
No, he is gone right now.
Okay. Now we're down to the last 10 or 11 minutes. Masafa probably is going to be the last call we receive. But let's go back to the meeting. We've got a big meeting coming up with the governor on the 30th. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Now, let me formally ask again. I know it's kind of redundant. What are the restrictions with respect to what kind of people and what community folks can attend?
Well, I saw the original planning list. They had names on there like Gary Cunningham from Northwest
Area Foundation.
Mm-hmm. They had Lester Collins from the Minnesota Council on Black Minnesotans. And I mean, they had some people on there that they want to address or have there with Mr. Dayton in the room to make it seem like, you know, there's actually some kind of plan.
Okay, okay.
Like, and it's really shameful because I understand that Mark Dayton, Governor Mark Dayton, is a business person.
Yes, he is.
And I understand that he's about business. And I'm wondering if he's seeing through this yet. Or he's just letting them, you know. I mean,
you know, I don't. I think it's a good question, Mr. Allen. We certainly are on point here. We can't answer that, if you will. We can't, you know, get inside the governor's head or the head of even his advisors. I don't know, you know, but you've already pointed out and we discussed it. The totality of this meeting is allegedly 1 hour and 30 minutes, though I doubt that UROC will revert to the practice that is their normal practice, and that is to order you out of the building. I mean, got to be careful doing that with respect to the governor, okay? But the meeting is a one-half-hour meeting from 5 to, 6:30?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's actually from 3. Let me go back to the invite.
Oh, that's right. That's right. From 3:30 to 5. 3:30 to 5, which is an interesting time, by the way, because a lot of common folk are not going to be able to take off work because, the boss ain't going to let them go to no meet with no governor, okay? You need to be here and protect this job that we gave you. So 3, 3:30 to 5, Mr. Allen, is basically a kind of a cocktail hour meeting.
Yeah.
Okay. So as far as a lot of the just the common folks, probably not going to be able to make it. By the way, that's a Wednesday, so that's mid-workday. You know, bosses, with the employment market being like it is, people understand the importance of doing everything they need to do.
Okay, we have a couple of calls, Mr. Edwards.
Well, go ahead, let's bring it in.
Caller, hold on, stand by. Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It's Mustafa again. I
hey,
forgot to mention that, Sherman Associates, which owns Caesar Riverside Plaza, got over $120 million from the government when they were promising to, you know, hire more people from the neighborhood and things like that. And Minneapolis Public School, the only contract they offer to the community are some phony organizations that claim to offer after-school programs. And it's all phony. You get the name and then, you know, fill out the paperwork. They don't even teach 1+1 anybody, and they know. So I think they are more interested corrupting our community than helping them by any way or form. And I think that's a worldwide policy that they practice. It's something based on colonial mentality that if they bribe few people, and make, they can control the whole community. And they kind of successful, you know, here in the United States and back in Africa and all many other third world countries. But the people are starting to understand that. But it's unfortunate, but it's, we need to educate our people. And, you know, I think that's the only way we can
fight
for our
rights. And we've had a number of discussions with you, Mustafa, and this goes back example to the whole tobacco thing that we talked about. By the way, let me ask you this question because it's important with respect to our audience. Did you make contact with Washington? Did you talk to Representative Carson last week? You know, you called in. We had a discussion about. Go ahead.
I called it in. You know, I wasn't able to. They were busy. They were not answering the phone. But I did talk to and send email to. I think you were talking about the issue of African immigrants in Libya, over 1.5 million immigrants.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Many of them by now got killed by the thousands, not hundreds, thousands.
Right.
Far as some people, I hear some people from Egypt and other sources in Libya. And I am still trying to do something. And I think we need your help. I contacted a Congressional Black Caucus office, and the lady I talked to, Latrice Powell, she promised that she will send out an email, but I haven't heard from her, and I tried to call back a couple of times. I think, you know, the best way to start for me would be to talk to our own Keith Ellison.
Congressman
Keith Ellison.
Yes.
But I don't expect, they even hang up the phone among people, so that's
yes,
just a waste of time, yeah.
Okay.
West of
all right.
We will
talk about that a little bit more at the top of the program next week, Mr. Allen. Don't you think that would be good? About what is happening with respect to that whole North African situation, and to try to find out what was done, as well as the situation, Mustafa, in the Ivory Coast and the Eastern Congo.
Okay, we have another caller. Caller,
all right, let's get him. I better get him quick. We're running. Go ahead.
Go ahead, caller.
Yes, my name is Charles. I really enjoy the show. I've been a listener for so many years with Mr. Everett's show, and now with this one, it's a great asset to our community. My question is what a position is the congressman taking from the 5th District, the one that cries on TV in reference to issues over in, you know, dealing with some other people? What issue is he taking about this wrongdoing in the school system and et cetera? And I would like your opinion on that. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Allen, you want to take it first, and then I'll just follow up and close it out?
Sure. With 6 minutes remaining, since I cannot read Congressman Ellison's mind, I would put it like this. There are Black, Asian, Hispanic, Latinos, Somali community here in the 5th Congressional District that are in desperate need of some leadership and some firm decisions to be made. But then again, as a lot of my colleagues agree with me, there's always a play for national news coverage. There's always a way to position yourself for the next time. I can't be mad at Congressman Ellison for taking this opportunity for C-SPAN national news coverage and shedding a tear and just doing the emotional piece and is really getting out there. Because, you know, to be a good politician, you also need to be a good actor, and you need to practice your skill both ways. So
okay.
That's where I'm going to put it right now. I mean, we need some tears.
I'm of the same opinion. I would have liked to have seen some emotional tears, first and foremost, for so many young African-Americans that died in this city last summer. Doing a tremendous spike in violence where we went from basically allegedly 19 homicides in 2010 to over 60 in 2011. I guess I would have liked to have seen some emotion from the congressman on that. I certainly would have liked to have seen an equal amount of emotion from the congressman with respect to the deaths and rapes of black Congolese in the Eastern Congo, and I certainly would have liked to have seen some expression and emotion as it pertains to the black women who were gunned down in the streets just a week or so ago in the Ivory Coast. And I'm kind of like you, you know, politics is also about theater. And there's some that do it better than others. And what we did is really had a match off up there between Congressman Ellison, who, you know, showed his emotion, and Peter King, the Republican out of Long Island, who seemed to forget that at one time he was on the government's list as a terrorist and an operative for the Irish Republican Army, who, by the way, were killing allies of the United States in the form of British soldiers who were involved in the conflicts, as they like to refer to them, in Northern Ireland. And so I'm like you, Mr. Allen. I'm trying to get with it, you understand, but I thought that there was an opportunity for a display of real sincere emotion and concern and tears for what's happening in your own 5th Congressional District, because there's some real sadness and heartache and pain being felt in this congressional district. And the caller asked us, what do we know that the congressman is doing? Like we both said, I can't get inside of his head, but I certainly can respond to actions or lack of. That's all I got. That's my position here on Black on Point.
My point. With that said, Mr. Edwards, I think that we should thank all our listeners domestically and internationally for listening today to On Point. And we'll, 2 minutes remaining, we'll be back next week at 4 p.m. Looking at some other things that are going on here in the Twin Cities. We appreciate you joining us. And if you live in Minneapolis proper, tune in to Channel 17, which is Minneapolis Television Network, at 5 p.m. That's Channel 17 in Minneapolis proper, Minneapolis Television Network, for Black Focus. And Mr. Edwards, what is your topic tomorrow on television?
Well, one of the topics that we certainly talked about the international set, but, you know, one of the things we feel kind of good about as a black journalist, Mr. Allen, was the fact that on the program and the arrest had not yet taken place. You know, there were arrests in Washington as it pertains to the attempted bombing on Martin Luther King Day, and the majority media did not touch it.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk a little bit about it on next week, but they were, white supremacists,
as
we had said on these programs back in January.
In the very beginning.
When folks were saying that the Ron and Don team didn't know what they were talking about.
Exactly.
Yes, there were arrests in eastern Washington. As it pertains to some of those involved in the attempt to bomb the Martin Luther King Day parade. So we were talking about it, and the arrest had not yet been made. So that'll be something we'll be chit-chatting about on the program tomorrow. But, hey, Mr. Allen, appreciate it. And, again, to our listening audience, we continue to appreciate you being with us, and we expect to hear some questions from you next week.
Thank you. Live from the McIntosh Studios in downtown Minneapolis.
Look, this isn't a Romulan labor camp. I don't have to answer your questions. And I don't give a damn what you think.
hot attorneys